Good morning and welcome. I'm Bob Morrison. I'm a senior policy fellow here at FRC. I'm glad to welcome you all here this morning for our lecture from Dr. Keenan Cureton. The Godless Constitution is a book that was published several years ago. It was written by two Ivy League authors, and it was widely praised as a timely, well-written, scholarly polemic for the separation of church and state, a ringing rebuke to those who want to eradicate the wall of separation. Not surprisingly, it got good reviews all the way from Harvard to Los Angeles Times. I thought, since they were noting the founders, I would go back and find out what some of those founders themselves had to say. James Madison, who is the father of the Constitution, said, "It's impossible not to see the finger of that almighty hand which has so frequently been extended to our relief in the critical stages of the Revolution, in the adoption of the Constitution." George Washington, who presided over that convention, might have known something about what they were doing. Washington said, "Once again, you can trace the finger of Providence in the action of the states which led them to the adoption of our Constitution." Tomorrow, we will observe in New York City the 220th anniversary of George Washington taking the oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. At the end of his taking that oath, President Washington said, "So help me God." And then he did something else that was significant. He kissed the Bible. All we are told in defense of a godless constitution. Our guest speaker this morning is Dr. Keenan Cureton. We are very pleased to have Dr. Cureton with us. He is Vice President of FRC for Church Ministries, and he holds a BA from Carson Newman College, and as well his Master's in Divinity and PhD from Southwest Baptist Theological Seminary in Fort Worth, Texas. An additional study at the University of Texas at Arlington and at the University of Lund in Sweden. Dr. Cureton's achievements include a most important effort in the year 2004 on the I Vote Values campaign, which he conceived and directed. He's been active with the Southern Baptist Convention as a vice president of that largest legislative assembly in the world, and he was active with the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Keenan Cureton.
Thank you very much, Bob, and glad to have our folks that are joining us by the web today. And talk about your hot potato. I've got it. The separation of church and state, the myths, the realities, and the results. You know, when most Americans, I think, that when they hear the word separation of church and state, they automatically default to the First Amendment. They think that's what we're talking about. However, those words appear nowhere in the First Amendment or in the Constitution. Now, despite that fact, the vast majority believes that Thomas Jefferson's metaphor of the wall of separation between church and state encapsulates the founder's original intent. Today, it's recited like a mantra by the courts, the media, political leaders, and even some religious leaders in our day who totally misunderstand this statement by Jefferson. But there's perhaps no metaphor in American history that has had more of a profound impact and effect on national policy toward religious freedom as Thomas Jefferson's wall of separation. In fact, this now famous phrase has been elevated to the status of constitutional law, and it's the guiding principle of American church-state jurisprudence. Again, this despite the fact that this phrase appears nowhere in any of our founding documents. And so basically what we have is the myth. The myth is that the wall of separation between church and state is actually in the First Amendment. It's not. Now, this myth became the law of the land in the 1947 Supreme Court ruling, Everson versus Board of Education, in which Justice Hugo Black, writing for the majority, declared the First Amendment has erected a wall between church and state, and that wall must be kept high and impregnable, and we could not approve the slightest breach. So part of the myth is that it captures the original intent of the framers, and then also this truth from John F. Kennedy. He says, "The greatest enemy of the truth is often not the lie, deliberate, contrived, and dishonest, but the myth, persistent, persuasive, and unrealistic. And again, this myth that's been perpetrated on the American people came through that Supreme Court ruling. There we go. There it is. And so that's Hugo Black's statement in that ruling. Now, while our founding fathers would have strongly disagreed with Justice Black and the way that the courts have subsequently applied that deceptive doctrine, they did not believe that the state ought to control the church and the church ought to control the state. There was a definite feeling about that. Now, even though the founders were very much religion-friendly, George Washington even named religion and morality as the twin pillars necessary for political prosperity, yet beginning with the Pilgrims and then the Puritans and those who followed them, religious dissidents came to America to get away from the religious intolerance that was perpetrated so much in the state churches of England and Europe. Intolerance had often led to persecution and war. Indeed, by the time the Constitution was written and circulated, there was such an outcry for a Bill of Rights that specifically addressed religious liberty that the founders were compelled to address the issue or risk that the Constitution would not be ratified. Since many of their forefathers had fled England and Europe in search of religious liberty, and since the founders believed it to be an unalienable right, they responded by designing a system of checks and balances to protect the church and the state against inappropriate influence either way, while at the same time guaranteeing the free exercise of religion. The result was that the House framed and the Senate approved what became the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights in the first federal Congress. See if we can get a little forward there. There are the Pilgrims. Here we go. Now, we've talked about the myths. Let's talk about the reality for a moment. Now, James Madison, of course, is often referred to as the father of the federal Constitution, as well as the father of the Bill of Rights. And he not only proposed a draft for the amendments, but he persistently pursued their consideration, debate, and passage. He was the champion when it came to the first federal Congress of moving the First Amendment and as well as the other amendments forward. Now, when you look at original intent, which is really what I want to get to in this lecture, not so much to debate, you know, where we are today, but I want to at least establish where we were to begin with. When we talk about original intent, it should be noted from the outset that Madison, who was the driving force, his religious views, writings, and activities were numerous, varied, and at times self-contradictory. So, you know, it's really difficult to get a handle on this guy. Indeed, his statements about religion can be used to support opposing arguments when it comes to church-state relations. And I think as you look at him, especially over a span of time, you get the idea that he kind of evolved in his perspective of church-state relations, and particularly if he's deemed as the author of the so-called detached memoranda, which was discovered back in the 40s and may or may not be actually his writing. It's claimed that it is, and if it is, then late in his life, he was decidedly not religion-friendly when it came to the public square. But what we should be concerned with are his intentions up until and at the time that he introduced the amendment for consideration. As an Episcopalian from Virginia, one would have expected James Madison to study at the Anglican College of William and Mary, but he went to Princeton. And there he sat under the direct tutelage of Dr. John Witherspoon. Bishop William Meade said this of Madison the student: "Mr. Madison was sent to Princeton College, perhaps through fear of the skeptical principles then so prevalent at William and Mary." Sounds like today. During his stay at Princeton, a great revival took place, and it was believed that he partook of this spirit. And on his return home, he conducted worship at his father's house, and he soon after offered for the legislature, and it was objected to him by his opponents. He was better suited to the pulpit than to the legislative hall. So people thought, hey, this dude's coming back. He's going to make a fine preacher. So he was tutored by John Witherspoon in the principles of Hebrew government, and he also was very much in favor of this amendment for religious freedom. And this is basically what he proposed on the front end. The civil rights of none shall be abridged on account of religious belief or worship, nor shall any national religion be established, nor shall the full and equal rights of conscience be in any manner or on any pretext infringed. He's kind of like us preachers. He's a little wordy. So, but that was his first shot. Now, as a member of the 1776 Virginia Bill of Rights committee that authored that, he had declared, "It is the mutual duty of all to practice Christian forbearance, love, and charity toward each other." So he was also on the congressional committee that authorized, approved, and selected paid congressional chaplains. This guy was religion-friendly on the front end, okay? And there are many statements to that effect that I have in the lecture that I can't get to because we don't have the time. But basically, here's what he proposed. Now, as we move forward in this debate, it's interesting to see what happened in the House as they debated his amendments, as he kept pushing them forward in the first federal Congress. And we're going to see what some of the other guys said. There was a 10-member subcommittee that was appointed under the leadership of Frederick Muhlenberg, first Speaker of the U.S. House, former Lutheran pastor, brother to Peter Muhlenberg of Virginia, to deal with the amendments that Madison had proposed. And this committee brought its first draft of the amendments to the House on August 15th. And the third amendment, which is now our first amendment, by the way, the first two went down in flames, but the third amendment, including the following abbreviated version of Madison's original amendment: "No religion shall be established by law, nor shall the equal rights of conscience be infringed." So that was kind of the shortened up version of the bloviating Madison. Sorry. And then the debate ensued. And so here's what happened. And where do I get that? I get that from Gales and Seton. This is an 1834 record of the congressional record. This contains the debates and proceedings. I pulled it straight out of this book. And here's what he had to say. This is very interesting. Look at that very carefully. He had some doubts of the propriety of the mode of expression used in the paragraph. He apprehended that it was liable to a construction or interpretation different from what had been made by the committee. He feared that it might be thought to abolish religion altogether. That dude was a prophet. So he saw the danger in the wording of the First Amendment as it had been proposed by Madison and modified a little bit as it came to this 10-member subcommittee. And we have another comment. Mr. John Vining suggested that, the propriety of transposing the two members of the sentence. And then Mr. Jerry said it'd read better if it was "no religious doctrine shall be established by law." And then Mr. Sherman thought the amendment altogether unnecessary. He figured the Constitution was good enough. We don't need to get into this business. Let's move on. Mr. Carroll said, "As the rights of conscience are in their nature a peculiar delicacy, and will little bear the gentlest touch of governmental hand," hands off, guys, "and as many sects have concurred in opinion," that's religious denominations, "that they are not well secured under the present Constitution," he said he was much in favor of adopting the words. In fact, he said that's the best thing he'd heard so far in Congress, if we went on and got the rest of his quote. Well, Mr. Madison said that, he understood it to mean that Congress should not establish a religion and enforce the legal observation of it by law or compel men to worship God in any manner contrary to their conscience. And he went on to say, again, the most wordy dude in the room, whether these words are necessary or not, he didn't mean to say, but they had been required by some of the state conventions. What's he talking about? He's talking about the ratifying conventions when the Constitution was out there in the states and they were approving it. People were saying, hey, we need something to protect our religious freedom. And so that's the point he's trying to make. So he's saying, hey, we've given power to the federal government to execute laws and to make laws, but the fear is that we might infringe on the rights of conscience and establish a national religion. So Mr. Madison said to prevent these effects, he presumed the amendment was intended and he thought it was well expressed as the nature of the language would admit. He congratulated himself for doing such a great job. I hate to beat up on the guy. He's a great guy. But Mr. Huntington said that he feared with the gentleman first up on the subject, which was Mr. Sylvester, that the words might be taken in such latitude as to be extremely hurtful to the cause of religion. He understood the amendment to mean what had been expressed by the gentleman from Virginia, talking about Madison, but others might find it convenient to put another construction on it. Again, interpretation. Reinterpret these words. Was that not prophetic? Wow. So, Mr. Madison, he has to reply to everybody. He thought if the word national was inserted, it would make it clear. But then he gets into a hornet's nest with some of the other guys in the room, particularly Elbridge Gerry, because of the debate about federalism versus anti-federalism. He was Mr. Livermore says he wasn't satisfied with it, didn't want to dwell on it, need to alter it, and he gave a suggestion. Congress shall make no laws touching religion or infringing the rights of Congress. Let's don't mess with this. Let's leave it to the states, is basically the idea. Mr. Gerry had to rise to the occasion to talk to Mr. Madison about his proposal of the term national. So, again, bringing up the old debate between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, the people who are in favor of the Constitution, the people said, oh, it reaches too far. We want states' rights. Okay. So that got into it. So Mr. Madison withdrew his motion. He took his ball and went home, but observed that the words, no national religion shall be established by law, did not imply that the government was a national one. So they had a spirited debate. So the question was then taken on Mr. Livermore's motion. He made the suggestion that Congress shall make no laws touching religion or infringing the rights of conscience, and it passed 31-20. All right, so from this part of it, as we go through, and I went through every comment that they made, and it's out of that book, from that discussion, several points become evident. Number one, the concern about establishment was directed toward preventing a particular sect or denomination of Christianity from gaining national sanction by congressional action. In other words, tax-supported church, just like in England, and in some of the states, by the way, like Massachusetts and others. So they didn't want the federal government doing that. Secondly, the term national proposed by Madison would have made the amendment more clear for those reading it in our day. We would have gotten it, but it had a negative connotation for some in that day because of that ongoing debate that I've already mentioned. And then thirdly, others expressed the concern that this amendment's original intention would be forgotten and that it would be used to prohibit public religious expression. Sylvester and Huntington made that point, and their concerns proved to be prophetic. Well, I skipped one there. Well, later in this, in the debate, moving forward, Fisher Ames, on the 20th of August, proposed and the House adopted the following reading: Congress shall make no law establishing religion or to prevent the free exercise thereof. Does that sound familiar? Or to infringe the rights of conscience. So, Fisher Ames really was the one, I think, more than anyone else, who is responsible for the wording of the First Amendment, as you will see, clause on religion, as you'll see as we move forward. Now, the Senate got this thing, and they began to work with it, and they debated it on September the 3rd. They had several revisions that they offered. Congress shall make no law establishing one religious sect or society in preference to others, nor shall the rights of conscience be infringed. That one failed, then passed on reconsideration. That happens sometimes. Congress shall not make any law infringing the rights of Congress or establishing any religious sect or society. Congress shall make no law establishing any particular denomination of religion in preference to another or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, nor shall the rights of conscience be infringed. But you're getting a tone here. These motions that are passing and failing. Make no law establishing religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, striking the words, nor shall the rights of conscience be infringed. We're getting close to Ames now in the House. And if I can make it go forward, there we go. Congress shall make no law establishing articles of faith or a mode of worship or prohibiting the free exercise of religion. Passed as a final, went to the House for consideration, and the House rejected it. They said, let's get together in conference on this thing and work it out. So they finally came up with, in the conference committee between House and Senate, these words: Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now that is what was finally accepted and adopted as part of the First Amendment to the Constitution. Now, these two clauses of this religion treatment in the First Amendment have two legal terms to them: the Establishment Clause, Congress will make no law, and then the Free Exercise Clause, prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So you've got two parts to it. Now, what in the world did the framers mean by an establishment of religion? What did they mean by that? Well, the discussion and the debate in both the House and the Senate that I took you meticulously through, and you've been nice people to bear with me, but I'm going somewhere with this, I promise you. Here's the deal. They did not want the federal government to sanction a certain denomination as the state church. Anglican, Congregationalist, Presbyterian, Baptist, Catholic, whatever, okay? Just like the Church of England. That's what they were trying to prohibit. Not prayer in school, not Bible readings in school, not Ten Commandment plaques in the courthouse. They were trying to prevent an established church like the Church of England. That's what their intention was. Now, it's clear when you get to the ratifying conventions that that's exactly what they meant. Governor Samuel Johnston in North Carolina said, I know but two or three states where there's the least chance of establishing any particular religion. What's he talking about establishment? The people of Massachusetts and Connecticut, they're mostly Presbyterians. In every other state, the people are divided into a number of sects. In Maryland, the Episcopalians are most numerous, so there are other sects. In Virginia, there are many sects. You all know what their religious sentiments are. So in all the southern states, they differ. Also in New Hampshire. I hope, therefore, the gentleman will see that there's no cause to fear that any one religion shall be exclusively established. We've already got plurality. There's all kind of Christian denominations everywhere. Don't worry about the establishment of a national church. That's his argument. Now, there are others who commented on that. The Baptist minister who was a delegate, Henry Abbott, he commented on it. He said, I believe the majority in our state are Presbyterians. He said, but if we're going to establish one, maybe it ought to be the Episcopalians. And so they had all this debate about religious denominations. Consequently, the First Amendment's establishment clause, Congress will make no law, was never intended to prohibit public expressions of religion, such as student-led prayer, Bible reading, public schools, the Ten Commandment plaques, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, okay? That's pretty clear from the original intent. So here's the original intent: to prevent the Congress from establishing a particular Christian denomination as a tax-supported, officially sanctioned national church. Now, since the wall of separation between church and state did not come from the debates and discussions of the framers of the First Amendment, where did it come from? Where did we get this mess that we're in today? Well, it was taken from an exchange of letters between the newly elected President Jefferson and the Association of Baptists in Danbury, Connecticut. And here's what the Danbury Baptist wrote. They said, we want religious liberty. That's what they said, and they want to make sure that we can keep it. So their concern is, though, that the Constitution is not specific. Religion is considered as the first object of legislation. Therefore, what religious privileges we enjoy as favors granted and not as inalienable rights. Okay, here's the deal. They thought that the First Amendment granted an alienable right to freedom of religion. That is, an alienable right is something that can be taken away from you, right? An inalienable right is an inherent right. It's a natural right. It's a God-given right. Let's be use a biblical worldview and say that. And so they were very much concerned that that the First Amendment really didn't mean anything. And they were experiencing, you know, the same kind of problems that they had been before the federal Constitution and the Bill of Rights passed, as they were after, because they were in a state church type situation in their state. And Massachusetts, I think it was 1833 before they finally got rid of the state church situation, where they were literally paying for the established church in that state. So the Danbury Baptists are concerned. They're writing the president. They supported him. And it's interesting, you know, here's a bunch of Bible-believing Baptists supporting a Unitarian who didn't believe in Jesus as the divine Son of God. Politics makes for strange bedfellows, right? So they're saying, hey, President, would you make sure that we have some help in this regard? And basically they're stroking his ego and saying, you know, we're praying that you will prevail through all of these states and all the world until hierarchy and tyranny be destroyed from the earth. You know, a bunch of preachers, that's how they talk. So they're very much concerned about their religious liberty. Now, what did Jefferson do? He waited. He waited a long time before he answered these guys, and he wrote several drafts, and we've got some of the drafts where he scratched out words. So he was very, very cognizant that this was an important letter. It wasn't policy, but for him, it was. I mean, it wasn't federal policy, but for him, it was a great statement of where he was coming from. So he writes back about the First Amendment. And he basically states that you're protected. But now, before he wrote them, I just wanted to point out this letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote to Benjamin Rush. And he basically, he shows his hand in this letter. And he basically says, you know what, there are a lot of people out there that hoped that they were going to get an establishment of a particular form of Christianity, but not with me around. The returning good sense of our country threatens abortion of their hopes, and they believe that any portion of power confided to me will be exerted in opposition to their schemes, and they believe rightly. He was a defender of religious liberty. I mean, because he was an oddball himself. I mean, he didn't have the typical beliefs. There were people who hid their Bibles when he got elected because they thought he was going to confiscate them. They called him an atheist. They did all. I mean, the 1800 election was wild. And if you have time, Bob will tell you all about it. but his his reference to natural rights, though, invokes a very important phrase, a legal phrase in that day, that meant that religious liberties are inherent and inalienable rights guaranteed to man in the Scriptures. So Jefferson believed that God, not government, is the author and the source of our rights, and that the government, therefore, was to be prevented from interference with those rights. And so that was basically what he answered to these Danbury Baptists, if we can get it up there. Okay, so here he is. He says, I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people, which declared that their legislature, First Amendment, make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building, here it is, drum roll please, a wall of separation between church and state. So there it is, the famous phrase. And so he's basically, as you read the whole letter, you find out that he's talking about a wall that protects the people and their religious freedom from incursion on that natural right, that inalienable right, by the government. It's a one-way wall, per Jefferson. At least when you read the context, that's the interpretation that I get. Now, so he's, you know, he goes on, he finishes his letter to them. And, you know, the question is, well, did he really, you know, did he really mean that? I mean, he, you know, he's the author of Wall of Separation Between Church and State. Do the courts have it right today, or do they have it wrong? Well, I'm going to tell you that his own actions as president are proof that the courts have it all wrong when it comes to Jefferson and that wall being a two-way wall. And here's the proof, if we can get it to go forward. Here's some of his actions as president. He urged local governments to make land available for Christian purposes. He agreed to provide $300 to assist the said Kaskaskia tribe in the erection of a church and to provide annually for 7 years $100 toward the support of a Catholic priest in 1803. These are some of Jefferson's actions. Signed three separate acts, setting aside government land so that Moravian missionaries might be assisted in promoting Christianity, quote unquote. Here are more of Jefferson's actions. All these are footnoted in my notes, by the way, if you need to look. He attended church each Sunday in the Capitol building, which Congress voted to use for church services, and even provided the service with paid government musicians, the Marine Band, to assist in its worship. And it, by the way, became the biggest church in the land at one time. Began similar Christian services in his own executive branch, both at the Treasury Building at the War Office. Man, he was a church-starting dude. And he authored the plan of education for the District of Columbia's public schools, which included these two textbooks, the Bible and Isaac Watts' Psalms, Hymns, and Spiritual Songs. Got all kinds of theology in it. You know a lot of Watts' hymns if you go back and look. Here are some more of his actions as president, if we can get them going here. He praised the use of a local courthouse as a meeting place for Christian services. He assured a Christian religious school that it would receive the patronage of the government. That's government support. And he proposed that the Great Seal of the United States depict a story from the Bible, Moses and the children of Israel, and include the words God in its motto. Not exactly a religion-hostile guy. And he closed his presidential documents with the phrase, in the year of our Lord Christ, by the president, Thomas Jefferson. Now, this would really tick off the ACLU and the Americans United for Church and State, if they ever got hold of this one, but Thomas Jefferson to Reverend Ethan Allen, that is kept in the archives by James Hudson, that you mentioned earlier, at the Library of Congress, is this statement. No nation has ever existed or been governed without religion, nor can be. The Christian religion is the best religion that has been given to man, and I, as chief magistrate of this nation, am bound to give it the sanction of my example. Not exactly a religion-hostile president. So, how did we get from the religion-friendly, or at least the religion-neutral environment of the framers of the first federal Congress, and even Thomas Jefferson, one of the guys that's way out here on the fringe when it comes to orthodoxy with regard to religion, to the religion-hostile environment that we have today? How did we get where we are? Well, the answer is the 1947 Supreme Court ruling in Everson versus Board of Education I mentioned earlier. There we go. Justice Hugo Black, not my hero, wrote for the majority. And while, you know, basically, you know, no, I don't think anybody would disagree with the ruling as far as what came down as far as the decision goes, it's the wording that's like an atomic bomb that blew up when he put out this majority opinion that basically has given us the foundation for church-state jurisprudence since then as we've advanced forward. So check out what he said. The Establishment of Religion Clause of the First Amendment means at least this, that neither a state nor the federal government can openly or secretly participate in the affairs of any religious organizations or groups, and vice versa. That's a two-way wall, okay? In the words of Jefferson, the clause against establishment of religion by law was intended to erect a wall of separation between church and state. Now, if he didn't make himself clear, look at this. The First Amendment has erected a wall between church and state. That wall must be kept high and impregnable We could not approve the slightest breach. All right, here is where we had the sea change, right there. Now, the wall of separation between church and state, that was quoted in an earlier Supreme Court ruling, but nothing like that. The interpretation that was added here by our friend, Justice Hugo Black, who, by the way, was a one-time member of the Ku Klux Klan. Yes, that's right, the Ku Klux Klan, known for their hostility toward Catholics and Jews, as well as African Americans and any other number of folks that they just didn't like. So, apparently Roosevelt had a gap in judgment there and put this guy on the court, and he's been paying us ever since with this majority opinion. Now, the problem with that, again, is when you look at the ruling, you look at the opinion, only two founding fathers are cited for evidence of radical separation, Jefferson and Madison, ignoring the over 200 others, maybe 250, you could go that high, who would clearly argue to the contrary, including the two cited, if they actually were examined a little bit more closely as far as what they did when they were in office and some of the things that they'd actually said. Now, here's what Jefferson said when it comes to, you know, trying to figure out original intent. He said, on every question of construction or interpretation of original intent, carry yourselves back to the time when the Constitution was adopted. Recollect the spirit manifested in the debates. And instead of trying what meaning may be squeezed out of the text or invented against it, conform to the probable one in which it was part. Go back, figure out what those guys meant to start with. Don't make it up, which is exactly what Hugo Black did, in my opinion. So what Jefferson warned against, I'm afraid the Supreme Court has done. Now, he also cited, by the way, he cited Jefferson, so we got Jefferson's word on making things up and being a strict constructionist in your interpretation of the Constitution. Well, he mentioned also Madison. What did Madison have to say about original intent? He said, well, I entirely concur with the propriety of resorting to the sense in which the Constitution was accepted and ratified by the nation. Go back to the time when it was accepted. In that sense alone, is it the legitimate Constitution? And if that not be the guide in expounding it, there could be no security for a consistent, stable, and stable, more than for a faithful exercise of its powers. He's a little more wordy than Jefferson, so I had a second slide, sorry. Check this out, though. What a metamorphosis would be produced in the code of law if all of its ancient phraseology were to be taken in its modern sense. It's exactly what these guys have done. Well, what Jefferson and Madison warned against, the Supreme Court has indeed done, and they've patently ignored the original intent of the framers of the First Amendment. So to say that, really, that they exercised poor judgment in that is really an understatement. What they did, I believe, was irresponsible, reckless, and dangerous. Now, further, one other thing that you need to understand about this ruling, it was the first case to apply a reinterpretation of the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment to the states through the 14th Amendment. Now, if you guys know your Constitution, you know the 14th Amendment was basically about what? Do y'all remember? It was about slavery, right? Racial civil rights issues. Basically what they did was reinterpret the 14th Amendment so that they could apply First Amendment to the states, not just to the Congress. Congress shall make no law, okay? So basically they're limiting the states not just on racial civil rights issues, but on the numerous items contained within the Bill of Rights. And in our case, we're concerned about the First Amendment, right? So apply to the First Amendment, the court created a mechanism whereby, for the first time, it could intervene in religious practices at all levels, national, state, and local. That's how they can say, you know what, we can't have that manger scene out there by the courthouse. Just can't do that. We can't have prayer at the ball game. So basically, they're getting more intrusive by applying the 14th Amendment. Now, there's a bunch of court cases I wish I could go through. We don't have time to do. But I want to go back again to the original intent argument because I want to beat this thing till it's dead, okay? Here's some nails in the coffin of the court-inspired myth. Number one, the courts are relying on a private letter of Jefferson's, not a public policy statement. I mean, who in their right mind, if they were trying to do a court ruling, would pick out a private letter and say, this is going to be the standard for church-state jurisprudence, a private letter? Goodness gracious. Secondly, the courts are relying on an opinion expressed by an individual, Jefferson, who didn't participate in the framing of the First Amendment. Where was he? He was in France. He wasn't even there. He didn't have any input on the whole process. So why quote him? It's kind of like if you saw an accident out here at 7th Street, okay, and somebody from the building who was in this lecture said, I want to testify as to what happened out there. What do you think the court would do? Get out of here. He wasn't there, okay? And so why should we even take his word for it anyway? I mean, he's an important figure in American history. He could be used maybe as a support to the original, you know, source documents and the original debates and proceedings, the original framers. Sure, he could use and be used in support, but he should not be used as the primary arguing point, which is what they did in the 47 ruling. The third thing is the courts are ignoring those guys when they made this ruling. So, I mean, you know, if they really believed in this wall of separation of church and state, don't you think that one of them would have said that in the debates and proceedings? Don't you think one guy would have said that? They didn't. So, here's what Rehnquist said. Love that guy. Lord bless his soul. That's his old picture from the 70s. Couldn't find a real good one. But I do appreciate Lindsay for trying to help me on these things. But I couldn't find a good picture of Rehnquist. I don't think I asked you to find that one, though. So that's my bad. But excuse the 70s hairdo, but he's got some wicked wit here if you look at it. It's impossible to build sound constitutional doctrine upon a mistaken understanding of constitutional history. But unfortunately, the Establishment Clause has been expressly freighted, loaded down with Jefferson's misleading metaphor for nearly 40 years. Thomas Jefferson was, of course, in France at the time the constitutional amendments, known as the Bill of Rights, were passed by the Congress and ratified by the states. His letter to the Danbury Baptist Association was a short note of courtesy written 14 years after the amendments were passed by Congress. He would seem to any detached observer as a less than ideal source of contemporary history as to the meaning of the religion clauses of the First Amendment. And to that I say, amen. Yeah, he's right. Now, consider for a minute, I mean, he nailed it, but can I just beat a dead horse till it's just pieces? The actions of the federal Congress at the same time they approved the First Amendment. Let's go back to them and what they were doing at the same time. Well, let's see what they did. Here's some of their actions. Number one, they established congressional chaplains. Not exactly a religion-hostile move. Paid by the taxpayers, and they're still doing it today, right? Number two, they reenacted the Northwest Ordinance, which Article 3 in that thing is very specific when it comes to schools and religion. Look what it says. Religion, morality, and knowledge being necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and the means of education shall forever be encouraged. So, it couples religion with public education in that statement. So, the framers of the Northwest Ordinance and thus the framers of the First Amendment believed that schools and educational systems were a proper means to encourage religion, morality, and knowledge, deemed necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind. So, when a territory applied for admission to the Union as a state, Congress issued an enabling act establishing the provisions of the ordinance as a criteria for drafting a state constitution. They had to agree to that to become a state, okay? Further, the day after the wording for what is now the First Amendment was approved by both houses of Congress, the chair of this 10-member House subcommittee was Elias Boudinot from New Jersey. And he proposed a Thanksgiving proclamation that we thank God for the establishment of this government, including these amendments. Thank God for the First Amendment? Whoa, I thought we couldn't do that. But here's what he said. He said, I couldn't think of letting the session pass over and without offering an opportunity to all the citizens of the United States of joining with one voice in returning to Almighty God their sincere thanks for the many blessings he had poured out upon them. And he recommended that a joint committee of both houses be directed to wait upon the President of the United States, basically recommended the President, to request that he would recommend to the people of the United States a day of public thanksgiving and prayer to be observed by acknowledging with grateful hearts the many signal favors of Almighty God, especially by affording them an opportunity to peaceably to establish a constitution of government for their safety and happiness. Let's thank God for these amendments. It's just unbelievable. But anyway, so there was a lot of debate that ensued. Robert Sherman got involved and talked about, you know, how Holy Writ backs this kind of thing up, that you know, the thanksgivings and rejoicings that took place back in the time of Solomon and the dedication of the temple and how this is like that. And, you know, we ought to just thank the Lord for this great, you know, legislative session that we've had and recommend this to the President. And so the resolution did pass, and the President proclaimed that day of public thanksgiving, November 26, 1789, one of the founding actions that led to our national holiday of Thanksgiving. This is a day after we approved the First Amendment that said Congress shall make no law establishing a religion. Interesting. Now, here's what's happened, basically, when we talk about the results here. We've talked about the myths, we've talked about the realities, and we're talking now, we're beginning to talk about the results. But the reality is, our modern courts have taken Jefferson's wall of separation, indeed that First Amendment, and turned them on their head. And now they mean the opposite of what they really meant to begin with. Okay? Now, here are the results. There are many, many specific examples of this agenda of radical secularization by some of our nation's courts and, by extension, various public entities, school boards, educators, and teachers. And they're all kind of court rulings between 47 and today, and I've got them all in my notes, but we can't get to them. So I'm just going to give you some highlights from some of the stupidity that has been wrought by this misunderstanding of this wall of separation of church and state. Here's some of the things that have happened. Some have considered it to be unconstitutional for a student to pray aloud over his school lunch. Yet, Congress has a chaplain-led prayer before every session, a tradition that began with the First Continental Congress in 1774. Also unconstitutional for a kindergarten student to recite, God is great, God is good, let us thank him for our food. And yet, the founders who drafted the peace treaty with Great Britain to end the war for independence began it with, in the name of the most holy undivided Trinity. There we go. Some have considered it to be unconstitutional for prayer to be offered in the name of Jesus at city council meetings and other municipalities and other places around the country. Yet, Jefferson signed his correspondence, as we saw, in the year of our Lord Christ. Unconstitutional in one place for a teacher to ask and for the, or a student to ask and for the teacher to answer whose birthday is being celebrated at Christmas. And yet, George Washington, in his recommendation of the Delaware Indian chiefs concerning the education their sons offered, you would do well to wish to learn our arts and ways of life, and above all, the religion of Jesus Christ. These will make you a greater and happier people than you are. Congress will do everything they can to assist you in this wise intention. wow, Congress is going to help out in the education of your kids about Jesus. Oh, boy, how far we've come. And then, this is one of the classics of all time, for two middle school students to bring their Bibles to class, their teacher confiscated the Bibles and proclaimed, "This is garbage," threw their Bibles in the trash can. This actually happened. Yet Fisher Ames, man most responsible for the wording of the First Amendment, was concerned about other school books gaining more prominence than the Bible and asked why then, if these new books must be retained, as they will be, should not the Bible regain the place it once held as a school book? Do you see the radical contrast there? Here's another. For some students to pray publicly anywhere in a public school in Alabama, where Judge Ira DeMint even assigned a taxpayer-supported prayer monitor to catch people praying. If we catch you, you're in trouble. Now, that has been reversed, by the way. But just to say that when these things go out, it has a dramatic chilling effect on people doing anything anywhere. They're just afraid to do anything in a school or in a municipality. And yet the very Congress that wrote the First Amendment made that proclamation for Thanksgiving. Here's another one. For a graduation ceremony to contain an opening or a closing prayer. You've heard that a bunch. Yet George Washington said at his inauguration, it would be improper to omit prayer to God as my first official act. And finally, just to kind of cap it off with a little of our first president, and I want to say something here because I really, really hate the way the liberals do this debate. Because here's what they do. They like to take you to the least religious founders. They like to take you to the guys who had statements later in life that were a little bit more crusty and hardened and religion hostile. And they like to point you to their statements. They like to use Jefferson as the pace setter for church-state relations. Right? He's the guy, wall of separation. I would like to argue that the guy who ought to be the pace setter for church-state relations ought to be the father of our country, George Washington. Now, if there's one thing that he was very concerned about, I think when he went to bed at night, he wondered, and he wrote a lot about this, he wondered, am I doing it right? People are watching. Am I setting the right precedents here? He got up in the morning determined. When he went into his presidential duties, he spent a couple hours in prayer and in the Bible every morning. But he wondered, am I setting the right pattern here? That was his concern. He wanted to be the paradigm, the model for how presidents were to be from then on. So for me, that's my guy. You know, Jefferson, great guy. Thank you for writing the Declaration of Independence. Thank you for doing all that you did for religious liberty. I'm very grateful for that, but this is my guy, okay? He's the first president. I think he knew a little bit about how he wanted this thing to go, and he was there, okay? He was there. He wasn't in France, which is where he sent Jefferson, when this thing came through, and he signed it, and signed on to it. And he did make the statement one time that if I thought for one minute that the Constitution would take away religious freedoms, I would have never fixed my signature to it. So here's what he says in his farewell address, which, by the way, Madison actually helped write the draft. So for all those who think Madison is a religious hostile character, at least in his early years, he was not, because he helped write this thing as a draft for Washington, who put the finishing touches on it. Of all the dispositions and habits that lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. In vain, look at this, would that man claim the tribute of patriotism who should labor to subvert these great pillars of human happiness, these firmest props of the duties of man and citizens. The mere politician, equally with the pious man, ought to respect and cherish them. No one should call themselves a true patriot who seeks to remove religion and morality from public life. Would you agree that's what he's saying? I think so. And let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion. Whatever may be conceded to the influence of refined education in the minds of peculiar structure, you know, your Enlightenment thoughts over there in France, reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in the exclusion of religious principle. Is that not what's happening in America today? We've deleted religious principle from the public arena, particularly kids coming up in schools. Parents are mostly at fault for not teaching it, but if the schools don't reinforce it, then we've got problems in society, and I think you can see that on all levels. And he finally says, it's substantially true that virtue or morality is a necessary spring of popular government. Who that is a sincere friend to it can look with indifference upon attempts to shake the foundation of the fabric? We are witnessing today a shaking of the foundations of the fabric. And when you look at this from the perspective of the culture war, I think it's readily available to our minds that the goal of the secular fundamentalist judges is, it's basically self-evident. These black-robed tyrants belong to a coalition of people who seek to destroy any reminder of our Judeo-Christian heritage so that they can pursue, without an accusing finger of guilt, their selfish, godless, and immoral agendas, whether it's abortion rights, sexual promiscuity, legalized sodomy, embryo harvesting, assisted suicide, denying a creator, and promoting evolution as fact, gambling, pornography, on and on and on the list can go. If you do not have religious principle, if you move that out of the way, then you can pursue this godless agenda with reckless abandon, which is exactly what has been happening. When you look at what has happened in our nation, you know, since these rulings, and I'm trying to get Pat Fagan to help me out on this correlation, but when you look at the 60s and you look at the social ills, whether it's unwed mothers, whether it's divorce, whether it's cohabitation, whether, you know, whatever, I mean, violent crime, on and on you can go, you can see this skyrocketing effect from the mid-60s up. Now, some of these do tail off, and there are reasons for that. But you can see a dramatic increase in social ills that times back to this period when these court rulings came down in 62, prayer, Bible reading, Ten Commandments, all these things came down. The schools then had to be more religion hostile and take it out. And I don't want to be misconstrued as saying that the courts are at fault, but certainly they are to share in the blame, I think, for the social ills that we are experiencing today. Just step back and look at what America is becoming. Look at the number of broken homes and broken parents and broken children. Look at the pace at which morals are missing and values are vanishing. And you see that we have gone the wrong way based on how the founders and the framers set forth this nation in the very beginning. Now, that's the culture war. What about the cosmic war? Well, that's exactly what Satan wants, is to muzzle the church. I mean, he wants our nation, as it says in Psalm 9:17, the Bible says that all nations who forget God are turned into hell. That's what he wants. He wants to stop the kingdom of God from coming on earth as it is in heaven. And I believe America is a key battleground. Remember the reason that the pilgrims came here, according to the Mayflower Compact? Why'd they come? For the glory of God and for the advancement of the Christian faith. Their mission was to propagate the gospel to the ends of the earth, quote unquote. And America has indeed become the fountainhead of evangelical missions around the world for the last 200 years, with 85% of the money for missions and 80% of the missionaries coming from this nation. No wonder Satan wants to take us down. And a primary means of his strategy is to muzzle the church through the myth of the wall of separation of church and state, so that he can go along with his mission unhindered, which is to steal, to kill, and to destroy. Well, I'm here to say that it's time to stop believing the lies of the father of lies. It's time we threw off the shackles of silence, and it's time to let our voices be heard. Because if we don't use our freedom to defend our freedom, we're going to lose our freedom. Thank you. All right. I think we have lunch. So who is our director of ceremonies for this process?
Do we have will you take a Q&A?
Oh, yeah, I'd be glad to. I think, James, did you intend on people getting lunch and coming back in and doing Q&A or what? Do Q&A now. Okay, cool. Great.
Nobody else raised their hands. I'm Peter Sprigg, and I work here at Family Research Council as well with Keenan. I thank you for that fine lecture. I wanted to make a couple of comments from the things that I've read about this. One is that the wall of separation, this metaphor, was not necessarily original with Jefferson.
Right.
And
Williams,
as I understand it, Roger Williams used it. But he referred to the garden and the wilderness.
Yeah,
and the church was the garden, and the world, or which would include the state, was the wilderness. And the wall was to protect the garden, to protect the church. In other words, not to protect the wilderness. You don't put up a wall to protect the wilderness. I don't know. Maybe environmentalists would do that. But the second point was, I would encourage people to actually read the letter from the Danbury Baptists and Jefferson's letter back to them in their entirety. It's easy to find on the web nowadays with the internet. Mm-hmm. And any of us who have dealt in the political arena or who have worked for a public official will recognize exactly what happened here. The letter of the Danbury Baptists was, first of all, they really suck up to Jefferson. They start off by really flattering him and everything. But then they're trying to get his support for their effort to eliminate the establishment of religion in the states.
In the states.
Basically, which was a big issue for the Baptists because Baptists were often persecuted by the state-established religions. And so they were trying to enlist his support in this effort. And then with understanding that as their purpose, when you read Jefferson's letter back, he basically writes back and says nice things to make it sound like he sympathizes with them without promising to do anything for them.
Typical politician.
So it's very much like what any politician, and if you have ever worked in a congressional office, you've probably written letters like this, where you try to be nice to the person who writes to them. You try to make them make it sound like you agree with them without ever promising to do anything for them. And that's all Jefferson really did in this letter. So not only was it not an official document like the Constitution, but it wasn't even really a strong statement of Jefferson's own convictions. Mm. It was an attempt to sort of, butter up your constituents, you know. So, it was only a couple of years ago that I first actually sat down and read those two documents in their entirety. And I just thought I'd share that.
Anyone else
have a question or comment?
Thank you very much for your talk.
Sure.
Why then did Hugo Black say what he said and write what he wrote? I mean, it was so much more reasonable and prudent to do what you suggested. Mm-hmm. Why did he use this material to make? I mean, was he just a godless man who motivated by that?
Well, as I said earlier, his background is dubious in that he was. Had a background with the KKK. So, I mean, that alone, you know, coming to a church-state situation, he had a bias going in. And really, when you look at the decision, it's thin. It's thin on research. Wall of separation was quoted only one time prior to that in Supreme Court cases, and I've got some ADF guys in the back room that can correct me. Jordan's back there, so. But only one time prior to that was it quoted. So, I mean, there wasn't a lot of precedence to build on here. I think he just had an agenda. Now, but the interesting thing is, I mean, people hear about Everson versus Board of Education. You think, oh, what a terrible ruling. Actually, the ruling is not terrible. It was the opinion that was terrible.
Yeah.
So the ruling was actually fairly religion-friendly, the bottom line of it. But the opinion was where the atomic bomb blew up.
So that opinion didn't really represent the other guys that, you know, voted in favor of that ruling. Didn't really represent.
Well, he was the majority. He was writing for the majority.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, but it was the actual words he chose and the mm-hmm. opinion itself that.
Yeah. That
was so bad.
That
okay.
then laid the foundation for all these other court rulings that I couldn't get into, that are just, you know, they're built on that faulty foundation, as Rehnquist would probably put it, in his Wallace v. Jaffrey rebuttal, the minority.
Thank you.
Yes.
I would like to comment on a book that I have, which I think has some relevance to this. It was a book by a judge by the name of Andrew Napolitano, and it's called The Constitution in Exile. Mm. And he talks about two schools of legal thought. He talks about the naturalist school, and then he talks about the positivist school. Mm. And the naturalist school said basically that our rights do indeed come from God. They are indeed inalienable. But anyway, Andrew Napolitano says, unfortunately, it is the positivists
That's
who are now in charge. Mm-hmm. And the positivists are the ones who say basically that any right that government gives you, it can also take away from you at its
exactly.
convenience.
And that was the concern of the Danbury Baptist. They were looking at the First Amendment as an alienable rights situation. And so they thought, hey, what the government gives, the government can take away.
Well, this is exactly the situation that we are facing right now. I'm seeing all kinds of attacks on free speech from both right and left. And I'm concerned about any attack on free speech, because this is, in any case, one of the so-called inalienable rights that
right.
we're supposed to have. And I'm seeing a lot of instances. Now, there was a book out also by a lawyer whose name was, I think it was David Bernstein, and put out in 2002. He came from George Mason University. It was called You Can't Say That.
Mm.
So
yeah.
anyway, it mentioned all kinds of restrictions now on our First Amendment rights of free speech, and that's going on more mm-hmm. and more. And I'm just reading with a great sense of alarm about increasing attacks on free speech, whether the attack is from the right or from the left or whatever the motive is. But in any case, that is supposed to be a God-given right. But then also there's another interesting book called Who Killed the Constitution by Thomas Woods and Kevin Gutzman. That's a very interesting book to read. But in any case, what has happened throughout our history, I just wanted to comment on this, is that we have seen this gradual evolution from the naturalist school of thought over to the positivist school of thought. And Andrew Napolitano says, unfortunately, it seems to be the positivist school of thought that has the upper hand in law these days.
Right.
Saying that if government can give you the right, it can also take it away at its convenience, not your convenience,
right.
its convenience.
Right.
So that's what we're saying.
Your statement about the freedom of speech and it being in danger, we should be very, very concerned about House Bill 1913, which is the hate crimes bill, because that is that one has the potential of leading us down a road where our freedom of speech is in tremendous jeopardy.
It's being voted on today.
And
so.
Of course, the whole question of what constitutes hate, that's in the eyes of the beholder and the ears of the listener. And because of the 14th Amendment there, it's like saying one man's villain is another man's hero.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I said, if you apply hate speech rules to one group of people, then that is a denial of 14th Amendment right to everybody else.
Mm. Yeah, and I think the opposition party did a fine job of pointing that out by offering up other people groups that should be protected, such as pregnant women, the elderly, the military, just showing the stupidity of that whole idea.
Yeah.
All right. Any other questions?
I wanted to ask if you'd take your book and your speech and your presentation to some of our local colleges, particularly in Virginia, which are many of them are named after presidents.
They wouldn't let me in the front door.
I know. Or even, you know, founding fathers, because I know George Mason. They will not allow the truth to be spoken there by the truth of the man, George Mason, whom I also have heard was one of the writers of the Bill of Rights.
Yes.
And he got in a fight with George Washington, and they did not speak really for years.
He was another champion of religious liberty. He really was.
Uh-huh.
Key figure in the Virginia.
Well, I think that's something we need to do, is to push in all these colleges. And, I mean, how dare these people be opposed to teach our young opposition to not only God's word, but our Constitution.
Mm-hmm. Right. Very good. I would just comment that, it's hard to argue with original sources. And what I find in these arguments, I think Bob referred to it in the introduction to Cramner and, I forgot the other guy's name, The Godless Constitution. If you flip through that book, they basically said, we're just going to dispense with the normal practice of doing footnotes to sources in this book, because it's just generally accepted that the founders felt this way or that way about church-state jurisprudence. So... Yeah, they don't want to wrestle with the original sources. And when they do wrestle with the original sources, they want to go to the detached memoranda. They want to use all these things that are after the fact, years down the road, some of these self-contradictory statements that either Jefferson or Madison stated, but they don't want to talk about the other 250 founding fathers, which includes framers of these documents, who definitely were religion friendly and not religion hostile. So it's tragedy that they don't truly educate, they indoctrinate.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Just one more question. I have a question about America's, increasing religious plurality, and I'm just wondering how that affects our appeal to original sources, the founding fathers, who obviously weren't able to see that, America was going to be a religiously plural nation as we are today. So I just wanted your comments on that.
Right. I think you see some of that, though, in Governor Johnston's remark about the plurality of Christian denominations, a recognition that, hey, we all don't believe the same thing, so we can't establish a national church. Certainly, George Washington, who's my model for church-state relations, his kind words to the Hebrew congregations that were throughout the country show that we should have what I believe is an accommodationist approach to religion. There's basically three approaches, and I didn't get into this because, again, in 1 hour I was trying to nail down original intent, but and not talk about today, but there's basically three approaches. You got the strict separationist approach, which is basically what the courts are following today. You've got the accommodation approach, first as being religion hostile, the public arena. The accommodationist approach is, hey, live and let live. If there's plurality, let plurality go. Let it, let it flourish, because we derive strength from that. And then there's the other one, which people always accuse me of, and that is the dominionist approach. We're trying to establish a theocracy. We're trying to take America back, to our Judeo-Christian heritage, and we're going to form a Judeo-Christian theocracy, and we're going to run this country, that kind of idea. And there are people in America who believe that, and very, very fine people. I just happen to disagree with them. I'm an accommodationist when it comes to the plurality issue and the issue of church-state relations. We got some really smart guys in the back of the room too. Now, I don't want to overlook Jordan back there, he can answer some of these questions a lot better than I can. Okay, you tell me when I'm not. Okay, I'm glad.
Do you think that if these arguments that you've put forward in this presentation were clearly presented to the courts that made these bad decisions, that they would have gone another way?
David Barton's done this a number of times, and I'm sure ADF has done it a lot as well. So they've heard it. They just haven't listened to it. Jordan, you want to comment at that point?
That's correct, and that David Barton has written briefs for us, and yeah. And they just because I think they're very committed to a worldview that religion is something dangerous that needs to be expunged from the marketplace of ideas, mm-hmm. and just cabined off in these little churches over here where it doesn't affect anybody. So, you know, it's more than a legal issue. I think it's just people trying to suppress the truth and unrighteousness, and they want to benefit from all the Christian worldview that the Christian worldview brings into a culture, but pretend like, you know, just secularism brought it all, and that's obviously not the case. Yeah. Jeff, do you want to add anything? This is Jeff Schaefer, who's another astute ADF attorney.
All right.
Well, I merely add the fact that it was not an absence of evidence that led to these decisions. This is none of this is secret stuff that you've been presenting. It's all available to the courts.
Oh yeah.
But they have
studiously avoided it.
That's right.
Thank you guys. Do we need to wrap it up soon, Peter? What time do we? One more.
Just one more.
Moira gets the last one.
Keenan, thank you. This was just excellent. So informing. Learned a lot. My question would be, where do the current justices stand on these issues on the court, the Supreme Court justices? I mean, is John Roberts going to clearly support what you've outlined?
Well, as I understand it, and the guys in the back of the room are the best ones to answer this question, but you've got four and one. You got four who are more on the originalist side. You got four who are more on the positivist school of thought, and you got one guy, Kennedy, in the middle who swings either way. What would you say?
I think that is correct, and that if one of the sad things that back with the Lee versus Weissman decision back in 1992, that was the closest we came to overturning a lot of the bad decisions. Mm-hmm. And if you read the Jan Crawford Greenberg book on the Supreme Court, she's an ABC reporter, kind of gives the inside scoop, that they voted basically to return to a more formal coercion test, where basically, what it would mean is that the government, you know, when they say you can't have a state church, to be a little more specific, what it means is that the government cannot use formal legal mechanisms to coerce people to, like, go to church or pay tithes or get, you know, you can't preach unless you have a preacher license. Mm-hmm. And that was going to be the test, which I think is the accurate test.
Yeah.
And then Kennedy was writing it and said, you know, I can't do it. And so internally he flipped his vote and struck down the prayer. We have two of the same justices, Scalia and Thomas, are still on. Roberts and Alito, I would think they'd go the right way, but we don't have a guarantee of that.
Yeah.
And I think rather than that being a cutback, I think it would be a very good thing if the Supreme Court said the government cannot use formal legal measures to coerce people. Because what we are seeing is, and this is probably going in a different direction, the homosexual activists, the universities, they use all those
coercive
mechanisms, and then we can attack them, but they're in denial that they're the functionally equivalent of a state church because they think they've got therapeutic motives to help, you know, brainwash you to think the right way. Mm-hmm. But they're functioning just like what the founders were concerned about.
Mm. Sensitivity training is basically like Sunday school.
That's right.
In their world.
The hate crimes is the blasphemy laws of the state church or the politically correct. You know, you can't speak against the doctrines of it. Mm-hmm. You know, diversity training is the is the catechism class, you know, college campuses, they force people to pay for groups. It's like forced tithing. You know, they have an equivalent of preacher licenses, et cetera. It's all the same things that they were warring against. So thank you. I just wanted to listen and not, but I'm happy to talk.
Thank you. All right. Well, I'm happy to turn it back over to Peter. Thank you very much.